OT After Dark is a podcast run by two occupational therapists and is for adults only. We believe that sex and sexual pleasure are a human right for consenting adults, regardless of ability, age, gender, or sexual orientation. We discuss topics that cover a wide variety of intimacy and sexual practices. To be true to our strong views regarding inclusivity, we use common and slang terms regarding sexual topics, which may be considered explicit. Listener discretion is advised.
We have exciting news to share. We recently partnered with DirectRec, a free app for OT practitioners, PT practitioners, and speech-language pathologists.
DirectRec helps clinicians to find peer-vetted products, and we recently have added our own recommendations of products on DirectRec for sexual health and wellness.
We helped DirectRec get a little extra sexy. DirectRec helps clinicians share products and other digital info, like YouTube videos and Google Docs, with their clients.
DirectRec helps you to track clients' follow-through on your product recommendations. So to start using DirectRec, click on the link on our website at otafterdark.com or in our social media bios.
Welcome to OT After Dark. I'm Kay.
And I'm JJ.
And we're both occupational therapists.
And we're here talking to you about sex. On this week's episode, we have the pleasure of speaking with Andrew Gerza from the podcast Disability After Dark and the hashtag Disabled People Are Hot campaign. He generously tells us about his sex life and opens up about it, as well as what it's like to talk to an occupational therapist about sex and intimacy when you have a disability. So hope you enjoy our conversation with Andrew. All right. So we are here with Andrew Gerza today, and we are so excited to have you on. So welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
If you could tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, kind of what you're doing on social media and everything, that would be great.
Sure. My name is Andrew Gerza. I'm a disability awareness consultant and crippled content creator. And I host a very similar named podcast to this one. And so it was so funny when I stumbled on yours. I host the Disability After Dark podcast and you host the OT After Dark. So that's why I reached out to you right away. And I was like, your show sounds like my show. We should talk to each other.
Right.
Great minds think alike.
Exactly. I also created the Disabled People Are Hot hashtag that's been going all over social media recently.
We love it.
I'm so excited about it because I didn't think it was going to go anywhere. And I just do work around sexuality, disability, and queerness. That's kind of my forte. And I really try to bring a lived experience model to this discussion because I'm not trained in this. I live it, so I feel like that's my credentials to do this. But yeah, that's what I do.
So we would love to start, since we're both occupational therapists. We read an article you wrote about your experiencing bringing up sex with an OT, and it didn't go very well.
No, it didn't.
Could you talk about that?
Sure. So this was a couple years ago. I want to say about maybe 7 or 8 years ago. And I was in my apartment and I had set up a meeting with an OT, and I didn't use OTs a lot because I just didn't like the way that they talked about disability. And through my youth, I just didn't enjoy working with them because they never really focused on what I wanted to focus on. So the OT came, we did our initial assessment, and this must have been our third or fourth visit. And she was young and she's about 25. So around my age, close to my age. And through the first few visits, I was like, oh, she seems friendly enough. We talked about, like, pop culture and things I liked, and she's getting to know me. And I was like, all right, she seems friendly. And I thought about asking her about sex because I'm queer, and I wanted to basically learn how to fuck dudes better is what I wanted to learn how to do. And I wanted to ask her. I wanted to ask her what positions would you recommend for me to get sexual pleasure? And so she was there, and we were talking about something else entirely, and then I said, so I want to learn how to have better sex. How can you help me with that? And I wasn't rude. I wasn't crass. I didn't say, hey, I want to learn how to fuck dudes. I said, can you help me engage in better sexuality, please? Or something like that. And she turned bright red, started giggling. I started giggling because I'm a nervous giggler. So I joined her in the giggling. But I was like, why is this funny? Why is this question, like, awkward? I'm genuinely asking you, like, what? What can I do? How can you help me with this? Because you're my OT. You just taught me how to, you know, put away a dish or take off my shirt. Why are you also not teaching me how to get down or take off a partner's shirt? Like, I find it so funny that they will teach you how to take off your own shirt, but there's no handbook on how to take off your partner's pants. How would you take off your partner's shoes? How would you take off your partner's boxes? Whatever it is, like, to have sex, how would you engage in something to give your partner pleasure? Because what if you want to be in a scenario where you're taking off their clothes? And when you're disabled, that's something that you typically can't do. So if there was like a sex and disability course that's like teaching you how to take off your clothes in a sensual way, I mean, I would sign up for that.
And I think you're bringing up this excellent point, because this is actually something we haven't really touched upon in terms of that, you know, how do you take off your partner's clothes in that sensual way and that kind of lead up to sex, not just the actual sex act itself.
Yeah. And I mean, there's foreplay, and I've talked about this a lot on my podcast. Foreplay is like really hard to engage in when you're disabled, because most of foreplay is the body, and it's mostly geared towards able-bodied people. So you really have to be creative in engaging in foreplay. So for me, foreplay is like conversation, jokes, like giggling, laughing, stuff that I can do that isn't necessarily physical. But when it comes time for my partner to take off their clothes, I have to kind of just lie there and let them do that, which is fine. It's a great show, and I'm happy to voyeuristically enjoy that. I do feel like I'm missing out on, like, I wish I could tear your shirt off right now in passion. And I constantly am met with, I can't do that.
So it surprised me. And I think what we're learning as we do this podcast, because we're in the States, and it is to varying degrees a part of occupational therapy education in the States. But what we are learning is it doesn't seem to be that way internationally. There seems to
be
a bit of a disconnect in how that's being addressed in OT education.
Yeah, I listened to your first episode, and when you were reading those stats of like how they classified sex, I was like, I've never seen this in Canada. I've never heard this. I was like, where do they get this? This is awesome. I've never heard of this, because it is not something that exists. And I think, like you said in that first episode, because I listened to the first episode 5 minutes ago, so it's fresh in my head now. But you said, like, you know, we're starting to get there, but it is not translating into practice, and that's a problem.
It is a problem, because it's difficult. I think we don't necessarily know the best way to bring it up. So it was interesting to me that it occurred to you to bring it up to OT, because what we talk about is, like, we need to somehow let people know that we could address this.
Yeah, but the only reason that I even felt comfortable bringing it up was because she was young and around my age. Yeah. Had she been the typical kind of the way you're paired with an OT, at least in my experience, the OT was a considerably older woman than I was, and I was like a kid. So I'd be like between 6 and 10, and the OT would be, you know, a woman in her 50s, which is fine and great. But like, there's no way that if my OT at that point was a woman in her 50s, I would have said, so I want to learn how to penetrate men. How can you? That's not a conversation I would have engaged in.
But do you think if the OT had brought it up in any way, you would have engaged in that conversation?
I don't know, because again, there's a weird boundary there where, like, if the OT brought it up, how would I feel? And I've never had an OT bring it up to me, so I don't know what that would. I think like what you were saying in that episode when I had, like, you can't bring it up on the initial assessment. So, like, at what point where is the line where you can say, okay, Andrew, do you date? And because I was clear too, like, OTs would ask me if I had a girlfriend. Oh, do you have a girlfriend? Like, in a playful, like, trying to get to know me, like, playful way as a kid. And I remember even as a kid being like, nope, but I certainly want a boyfriend. Like, but not knowing how to say that, I just let them assume I was straight because it was easier and felt safer to just hide that.
Mm-hmm.
But I never said anything. So I never felt comfortable. And I think at this point, because when I talked to this OT, I was like 28 and I was living on my own and I didn't care anymore. I didn't give any fucks about what they thought. I just said, mm-hmm. I want to. And again, I didn't say I want to fuck dudes. I said, can you teach me how to engage in sexuality better? I knew how to be polite, not crass. I didn't want to like really scare her, but she got so scared that she was like, oh, I'll look into it. And then
never comes up again.
For the record, as if I were your OT, you could have said you wanted to fuck dudes and I would have been perfect.
Totally.
See, but I mean, I think for youth too, like I'm in my 30s now, so I'm definitely not a youth anymore. But like when I was coming up 17, 18, I didn't use OTs because I got tired of the way they infantilized my kind of growing up in puberty and trying to figure all that out. If we had OTs that gave a shit about how growing up as a disabled kid could be really traumatic, not always, but can be really traumatic because of ableism and because of the way people dismiss us. If I had an OT that understood that I was 17, 18 and wanted to go to parties and wanted to like be with my peers, I never did all that. So if I had an OT where I could talk about how I can't access friends' apartments or do the things or be with my peers, and now, again, not just about sex, but about that socialization of a young person.
Mm-hmm.
If I could have talked about that with an OT, maybe the OT could have said, like, okay, let's look at accessibility options to make that happen. Let's maybe talk about ways you could be at the party in a different way, or ways you could ask your friend to build the ramp, or you could ask your friend to, like, having somebody with a little bit of authority who could say, yes, Andrew, we can find a way to get you to that party. Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Right. Knowing that that's important to you and you want to be with your friends and doing what all the other kids are doing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, for teenage kids, there needs to be OTs that are relatively young, in their 20s, who are able to talk in the language of a young person,
mm-hmm.
so that they feel like they're heard. Because again, if I'm 17 and my OT is 50, I'm not bringing this stuff up to you.
Right, yeah. I mean, yeah, that's going to be, you know, like I wouldn't feel comfortable talking to somebody necessarily who's in a different generation. And
it probably doesn't help that most of us are women too.
Yeah.
I mean, I did have one male OT, but for me being queer, that even felt weirder because I was like,
oh, yeah.
I was like, how do I, like, so I felt more comfortable expressing my queerness to a female OT or female identified OT rather, because it, I don't know, they seem more receptive when a dude says I'm gay. Female identified people seem to be like, all right, no big deal,
mm-hmm.
and move on. Whereas when you address that with a man or a male identified person, there can be like some internalized homophobia and stuff that they have to deal with when you bring that up.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt uncomfortable bringing it up to them, one male OT that I ever had, because how does the session go once you admit that you, like, how can you make them feel comfortable too in their workplace?
Mm-hmm. Which is unfortunate because I feel like you shouldn't have to worry about that. I would hope that occupational therapists would, but I know we're not as a profession always making people feel comfortable, bring up everything that needs to be discussed.
And I just think that what we need, like, I think anyone can be an OT, and I'd love to see more trans and non-binary OTs.
Mm-hmm.
In that environment. I've never met a trans or non-binary OT, and I think that population, this is because we talked about gender for a minute, just that population going into OT work could change the whole way the OT is taught.
It I agree.
Change the way we talk about bodies and change the way we talk about, like, all of that stuff. And so I just think that we need more. And I'd love to see disabled OTs too. Like, where's that?
I know. There are some.
Yeah. There are. I have a question. So you're talking, you said growing up getting OT, they never really focused on what you wanted to work on. Like, at any point were you asked as a kid what was important to you?
No, I'm sure I was, but I was never asked as somebody who could remember. Like, I was never asked to the point where I could remember being asked that.
Yeah.
And like, because OT stuff when I was coming up was in the late 80s and 90s and kind of to the mid 2000s, it was very much still from a rehabilitative model of like, we're mm-hmm. going to fix you, Andrew. We're going to make you be able to do this. And so at the time, because I wasn't invested in like disability justice and it wasn't something that I really did yet, I wanted that. I was like, okay, yeah, I want to be normal. I want that validation. And sure, if this means I can do this, great. Now, I would love it if an OT would ask me, if like, hey, what do you want to achieve? But even when I have OTs now, because I get it through, sometimes I get it through the provincial, which is like the state healthcare system, will come in and let me have an OT for certain assessment things. And they'll be like, okay, so we're going to do this, and that's it. So you only get 4 visits to figure out what you want to work on. And on the 4th visit, you're supposed to know, like, you're supposed to know what you want to do. And that's just not how occupational therapy works. I feel like when you're disabled, whether that's acquired or congenital, you should be assigned an OT or a team of OTs, and they should go with you through your whole life, because you want to build those relationships with an OT are so important. And when the state only provides you 4 visits, how can you do anything in that time?
I can't imagine, because there's such a relationship that really needs to be built so that you can get to, like we said, you're not bringing sex up right away. But if you've been working with the same person, regardless of their age, over a period of time, those conversations get easier.
I feel like childhood, though, children with CP or congenital disabilities or spinal cord injury, they get a lot of attention from OTs. And they have OTs, at least in my experience when I was coming up, they had OTs from the time they were a kid, mm-hmm. all the way through to 18. And then the minute you turn into an adult, you are not given those supports anymore. You're expected to ask for them. And then if the state feels like they can provide it to you, then we graciously gave you 1 performance. It's like, it shouldn't be how it is.
Right, right. Yeah, there seems to be this huge kind of drop off once you enter the world of adulthood in terms of services, which becomes like a huge, you know, occupational justice issue.
It really does, because of why. And by the time you age out of the system, you're really not an adult yet. Like, when you're 18, you're still basically a kid until you're like, I'm 35 next month, and I still don't feel like an adult yet. So, like, you know what I mean? So, I think that there needs to be more discussion on the importance of that relationship between OT and client, and mm-hmm. how positive it could be if we just started pairing, like young OTs with younger students. And I'm not saying that woman in her 50s that does occupational therapy isn't great, but maybe keep her with like the 6 to like 10 age range for now. And then when the kid ages, hits puberty, put them with somebody who can speak their language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you had talked about how the OT clearly was not a big help in terms of getting you to where you wanted to be sexually, so you could fuck some dudes and rip off someone's shirt. So how did you go about doing that then? Was there someone that helped you, or did you have to just figure it out on your own? Or
I didn't start having sex until I was 19, which now, I regret my first time. It was horrible, and I wish I could have saved it for somebody who gave a shit about me. But I remember having to learn and teaching myself how to do it, and putting a lot of expectation on my non-disabled partners about, if you want to get naked with me, you're going to have to do most of the work. And I'm still kind of that way in my sexuality, because I can't do it. I just can't. So I have to let them do it for me. And there's a sensuality in that. Like, I like that they can take off my clothes, and then they, like, I like that part of it. That's important. But I do miss the fact that I can't take off their shirt. And there's something that I think is missing from that. And so I have just had to learn to accept what I can't do, as like, I can't rip off your shirt, I can't take off your pants. And I did an episode recently where I talked about how I was with somebody recently and I couldn't jerk them off the right way, and I was pissed off because my muscles didn't work and I couldn't get my partner off the way that I wanted to. And they, they were very polite and pleasant about it, but you could tell halfway through they were like, this guy can't give me the friction that I want to feel that pleasure. So they ended up doing it themselves, and it was fine. We enjoyed ourselves. But there was a brief moment of like, oh, I can't provide this to you. And I got really mad at my body, because I'd love for there to be an OT class of like, how to give a good hand job. When you have
right?
Muscles. Like, where the fuck is that class? I would totally
say maybe we should start that class. I think that might be an episode.
Like, I will come back. Let's talk about that.
This is how you give the perfect hand job.
Yeah.
Well, and all the sex toys, because we did a couple episodes talking about sex toys and some accessibility, but not a lot of accessibility.
Yeah, there isn't. And I know I listened to that one just now, and I noticed that you talked about me. You didn't.
We didn't know we were talking about
you. Nobody like realized my name, and then I was like, I know it's me, but I'll just wait until like. So that's why it was so funny we're talking today, because I was like, I know they're talking about me. I know they are. So yeah, so the campaign my sister and I are working on is called Deliciously Disabled, and it's a brand around, we're hoping to move it into like a lifestyle brand, the whole disability thing. I love building, my thing is, like what really gets me off about disability justice is building brands around disability that are about the experience. So I have like 5 brands that I work under because I just love making things disabling, like language and making it fun. So like Deliciously Disabled is about really bringing sexuality into that, but it also doesn't have to be about that. It can be about lifestyle stuff and all those things. But these toys, we wanted to really build something. Initially, we thought we were going to create something from scratch. And the more and more we do this research, the more and more we're like, oh, it's really the idea of creating a whole new technology or a whole new thing is super complicated, way more complicated than we both understood when we thought about the idea. So now our focus is shifting to disability-driven design, which basically means have a disabled person in the room with you through the whole process from conception to market industry building. The whole idea of adaptive toys, the idea is nice, but the problem is you're adapting it, which means you're not putting the disabled person in the driver's seat to say, how will this work for you? I have no problem if we physically adapt a toy, that's fine. But if you're creating something without a knowledge base, who are you helping? So my goal is to use my lived experience and my knowledge base, as my thing falls into my ear, sorry. Hang on 1 second.
This all good. Fun
interlude for anybody listening. Yay! So it's in now. Okay, good. So like with the knowledge base that I have, I can use my knowledge to help them adapt toys properly and help them, and will help us really, because it's my sister and I's idea. Mm-hmm. Help us really bring something to the market that puts disability first. That's really the goal. It's to not make the trouble that I have with adaptive technologies and the way it's marketed. Even with the awesome person you spoke to, I would listen to the whole thing and I agree with a lot of what he said, but I also took issue a little bit with, like, you don't want to do it for them, you want to do it with them. It's not for the disabled, I mean, yes, it is for the disabled person, but it's with them and using their knowledge base. So like, I just think that these toys we want to create are going to have a disability-driven design, which I think is powerful in the market because we don't see that right now. Everything, we are in a lot of areas, but especially in this area, with adaptive toys, it feels like an afterthought. It feels like, let's throw a strap on to this already invented dildo and then call it adaptive. That doesn't, I mean, yes, that might be the end solution, but why don't you change the marketing so that it's disability driven as opposed to like, oh, well, we adapted this for you. Like, and I feel like just generally, and I'm sure you know, a lot of OT stuff, the way we talk about adaptation is kind of, again, an afterthought. Oh, we adapted this normal fork for you. We adapted this clothing for you. We retrofitted this house for you. We didn't create the house for you with you in mind. We adapted it. So I think everybody's heart's in the right place, but I think the language around how we talk about adaptation definitely needs to be shifted.
I like that, because I do think, even for OTs, I think a lot of time we get equipment, and I know even me personally, I think, who came up with this? Because even I know, like, they weren't really thinking about whatever abilities somebody might have when there's certain things are...
They were thinking, and you know what? And I also find it troubling that a lot of these adaptations are built primarily for spinal cord injury having individuals, which is, you know what, again, no shade to them. I love you all. You're all great. But there is an inherent sense of privilege with spinal cord injury people because they were once able-bodied. So they come to the table with a lot of internalized ableism because they're mourning that loss, which I don't understand, but I can appreciate it. But I think we need to discuss how people with congenital disabilities exist too. And it's a different experience entirely, but it needs to be understood from a occupational therapy standpoint because that's going to change how you create things for the individual and create a plan for the individual to do certain things.
Yeah, and because I think that's, and you kind of spoke to this earlier, that idea of how you were treated as a kid by OTs, this idea that somehow if you weren't like able-bodied first and then like somehow you have a different view of relationships and sex, like there's this like,
but I mean, you know what, it's funny
because somehow,
because you do have a little bit of a different, that is partially true, I think, because when I think when it comes to sex and dating, again, no shade to spinal cord injury having individuals, I love you all, you're all great, I'm not shading you,
but no, we agree completely that it is, there's so much focus on spinal cord injury, especially with sex and intimacy, and it's like everything else is forgotten.
It's like, so, you have quote unquote, you know, normal, typical sex before, and now you have an injury. How do we get back to doing what you used to do versus just looking at it from just sex in general? Like, how does everybody get to have sex no matter what, no matter who you are?
Yeah, exactly. And I think when it comes to dating, especially if we're looking at non-disabled and the disabled couples, I'm going to use, even though it's a contentious term, I'm going to use it, the inter-able couple. If we're looking at intra-able couples, like there's this belief that if you were paralyzed or you had an accident, that it's easier to fuck you because you were once able-bodied. Whereas when I come rolling in my wheelchair and say, hey, I have CP, I was born with CP from birth, somehow I look like an alien with two heads that cannot be talked to.
Right, but you're clearly still a very, you know, sexual being. You still have the same wants and needs that, you know, other people have as well. Like, we are all sexual beings.
Yeah, I mean, and I just think there's a huge dichotomy between acquired disability and congenital disability that nobody seems to want to explore. And I think it's important that we recognize that not every disability is the same, and that's fine. But in terms of an occupational and physical therapy standpoint, we need to start accepting that and moving forward. Like, for instance, I'm working with an OT right now, a private OT that I've hired to help me in a new wheelchair that I'm trying out, which I am trying to get seating for it, and it's not that comfortable and we're working on things. And so we're talking about, she's trying to put me in a quote unquote proper sitting position. And I constantly have to remind her that the way you want me to sit is how an able-bodied person would sit. My body does not go that way. I cannot sit that way. So my normal is a bit slouched or a bit this way or a bit over this way. My hips are maybe this way. My normal is not at 90 degrees sitting perfectly.
Yeah, right.
It's different. So getting her, and she understood that kind of implicitly when we talked, but getting that conversation out and saying, like, this is my normal. It's okay if I'm not exactly perfect. Try to look at it from a disability standpoint as opposed to an able-bodied one.
Absolutely. If you had one message for the occupational therapy world, what would it be?
If I had one message?
it could be. I guess it's hard to kind of pinpoint.
Wow, I could give you like five paragraphs.
Give us as much as you want.
the message that I would give to occupational therapists are, work with disabled people, not for them. Work with them. Listen to them when they give you a complaint. And if they have the balls to ask you about their sexuality, they care enough about their sex life and your relationship to ask you. It's a privilege to be asked by a disabled person those questions. And if you're an OT student and you're in a classroom, start standing up and asking about sex, because typically they'll gloss over it. It's a really quick paragraph in a textbook. If that paragraph interests you and you want to know more, stand up in the classroom and ask the teacher about it. Let the teacher blush. But it's something that needs to be brought up in the classroom when you're a baby OT. And I have a friend who actually left the OT environment. She trained to be an OT, studied it, and she published a bunch of articles in, I think, the American Journal of Occupational Therapy. And when she submitted the same article, it was about anal sex and a friend of ours that was had a stroke and wanted to engage in different kinds of sexuality. So when she submitted that to the U.S. Journal, they took it. It was great. When she submitted that to the Canadian Journal, they said, the content offends us.
Aww.
Oh, that sucks.
And it's like, you know what? This is the problem. The study of occupational therapy, and I think you said this in your first episode too, it's super classist, and it's run by a bunch of, it was started by a bunch of like hoity-toity white women who who meant well, I'm sure, but come at it from a completely different classist perspective. Like, I have never seen an OT of color. Never. In all my time with an OT, I've never once seen an OT of color. And I know they're there, but I have just never seen one, which speaks to, like, again, does OT have a racism problem? Does, like, these things really need to be addressed so that every population, because what if you're a person of color who's disabled? Wouldn't you maybe rather work with a person of color as an OT? So when you talk about specific things that affect your day-to-day as a person of color, you can navigate that with somebody who gets it, as opposed to like to a white person with all this privilege who doesn't understand. So I'm just saying, like, overall, the practice of OT needs to incorporate queerness, needs to incorporate disability, needs to incorporate race. We need to do a much better job. And I think my friend that I talked to, and I used to have her on your show, she's amazing. Her name is Natalie Rose. I will put you in touch with her because...
Yes, please, that would be fantastic.
We had this great talk, and she's like, you know, OT is such a weird pseudoscience because it's not really, you're not really a doctor, but you're in their lives a lot. So how do you navigate all this stuff? And so we just had a really good conversation. So I just think, anyway, long story short, what I would tell OTs, open your mind a bit, realize that when you're done being an OT, when you've retired that title, you're going to become disabled too. And what would you want? Like when you age out of life and your OT, like, and your disability starts becoming an issue for you, what would you want? Do you want to be denied your sexuality all of a sudden because your disability happened for you? Like, just remember that even though you are in a place of authority as an OT and you're like shaping this person's ADL, it's going to be you one day. And when the OT is nervous about your sex life, how are you going to feel?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, you know what? I would love to, if you still have some time. We kind of talked about all this concept of OT. I'd kind of like to move in the other direction and really talk about, like, being queer and disabled and your life and your experience and just what that means to you and get into the fun stuff.
Oh yeah. Like that, I mean, being queer and disabled, I've been queer. Really, if I look at it, I've been queer since I was 4 years old. I knew I was into dudes since I was a little boy. I didn't know what that meant, or didn't have language for it, but I knew. And my queerness was never an issue until I started actively trying to be with dudes and realizing very quickly that they didn't want to be with me because of disability. Then I realized that disability justice had to be included here. And when I was coming up in school, I studied law, so I wanted to be a lawyer. I was going to be like a lawyer, just a lawyer, not even looking at disability justice, just the law. And I really quickly realized, where the hell are my stories as a disabled person? So I really quickly got into disability justice really fast. And then when I realized nobody was talking about how disabled dudes can also suck dick in popular culture, I was like, well, I can do that. I can write pieces for that, and I can talk about that. So I contacted places like Huffington Post, just a cold email saying, hi, my name is Andrew Gerza. You don't know me, but I have a story to tell. Can I pitch for you? And I just did that for a couple of years, having no knowledge of what it was that I was doing, just trying to get my story out. And so my experience of queerness and disability has been great professionally. Personally, ableism has been a real bitch. People are really scared to engage in discussions of sexuality and disability. So I've started engaging with sex workers to have my needs met, because And I treated it like therapy.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I got tired of going on Grindr, going on the apps, trying to meet somebody the quote-unquote conventional way and being met with ableism. I just got tired of it. So paying some money for somebody to make you feel good and also give you that pleasure for 2 hours while also feeling good is one of the best things I could have done. And I'm not advocating that. I guess I am. I'm advocating that if sex work is something that is financially viable for you,
mm-hmm.
something that you, if we can get over our stigmas about what we think sex work is and start looking at about what it actually is, it's time with the person who gives a shit about your body and sexuality. Mm-hmm. That's really important. And I wouldn't trade that, those experiences, for the world, because, like, honestly, as a disabled queer man, sex work gave me my sex life back. Before I started working with sex workers, I hadn't had sex in almost a year. I hadn't really had sex for a long time because every time I did, I was constantly met with ableism. So mm-hmm. my queerness and disability comes together in those moments.
Yep. Sex fun.
I'm very proud of it, but I love that my queerness and disability has allowed me to do the work I do. I mean, I've gotten to fly all over the world talking about this stuff, and that I'm so honored that I get to do that. So, mm-hmm. and I also just love getting down with people. I like getting naked. I just like the act of sex mm-hmm. as a disabled person and all the ways that I can engage in sex that aren't from an ableist perspective
mm-hmm.
and that can completely blow someone else's mind. Literally be like, wow, we've never had sex like that before. Like that, there's something really powerful in that. And I'm always excited to do that.
When you talk about sex from an ableist perspective, is your experience been that people are like, there's just one way to have sex, and if you can't do it that way, then it's not worth it?
There's an expectation, especially I think in the queer male community, of a very particular body aesthetic, a very particular way of looking and being. And if you don't fall in line with that, you are dismissed. And I don't fall in line with any of those things. I mean, I joke around that I have a big dick, and I joke around, I mean, I do, but I joke around all that stuff, but I do it because I want them to see that it's okay to laugh about this. And I have a friend of mine named John, and I asked him if I could tell the story. We started seeing each other almost 2 years ago now. And we see each other casually, we fuck around sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And he started calling me potato because I'm a vegetable and I can't really move around in bed. And initially, you know, I thought I was going to be offended, but realizing that he understood that I joke around about my sexuality too, and realizing that it was a way for him to endear himself to me and realize, like, hey, you being in a wheelchair doesn't bother me. Mm-hmm. Disturb me, I'm still gonna fuck you. It's okay.
Mm-hmm.
To play with that humor was really powerful because it meant that, because I call myself openly a triple, I call myself this language quite openly to not only shock people, but to show them that I'm comfortable. And if you can't get on my level, then we probably can't hang out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when he called me potato, I laughed and I was like, you get me. You're starting to understand that I have a sense of humor about this. And like, it was a really special moment for me that he called me that. Now whenever we fuck around, sometimes he'll yell out potato during sex. there's something really special about that because he's understanding that my disability is a part of this.
I love that. Could you, kind of on the same topic, but I've seen on social media you talk a lot about inspiration porn.
Yep.
Could you explain what that is to our listeners and
how you feel about it?
Oh, wow. Okay. Inspiration porn is the use of disabled bodies in images or film or books or anything really to make able-bodied people feel better.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what it is. The use of the disabled body to uplift a disabled person or make them feel better. So it's like, at least I'm not like that, or we were going to enable you to not be disabled, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Like,
it can be really subtle or really obtuse, but inspiration porn really is not allowing a disabled person to live fully in their disabled body. and using their disability as a way to uplift yourself.
Okay. I like that. Yeah. Any more questions, JJ?
Yeah. Anything else you want to tell us?
Everyone should listen to my podcast.
It's fantastic, by the way.
Everyone should listen to Disability After Dark. I'm going to have you, lovely hosts, on my show soon.
Woohoo!
Always need more content. If anybody wants to follow me on the places, one thing that I want to remember that I didn't want to tell you is that right now the Disabled People Are Hot shirts are being sold. So I will send you the link where people can buy it, and you can put it in the show notes. That'd be great, because it's a super long link.
We'll put a link on our website for you.
Yeah.
So people can go to it and get them there.
And what I'd love to actually quickly say about that is I'm also asking people who have financial means to donate $25 to $45 to me, and then I can give a shirt to somebody on low income who wants to support the campaign but has no money. I really feel it's important that I use my platform to say, hey, let me give back to my community and give them shirts for free, or give them something for free, mm-hmm. because there's so many people that want to support the idea that disabled people are hot, but they can't afford it. So I'm using any money that I get from donations, and I'll send the link there too, to give it to community members. And I just think that's awesome.
It is. It's fantastic. It's awesome.
And I guess my handle's Andrew Gerza on Twitter, the Andrew Gerza on Facebook, and Andrew Gerza on Instagram.
Excellent.
Awesome. Thank you so much for talking with us, telling us about your experience and how important it is to talk to people about how they want to fuck.
Thank you for letting me ramble on with you for an hour. It was such a good time. Yeah.